Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the economic challenges ahead facing the new Secretary of the Treasury and the extent to which he understands them. Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, joins us to discuss whether Jack Lew recognizes the systemic risk posed by the big banks and whether they are sufficiently regulated to prevent another meltdown, which the Treasury will not have the funds to bail out next time. Then, with President Obama having just met in the Oval Office with Afghanistan's kleptocrat-in-chief, Karzai, we'll be joined by Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer who has spent 5 weeks on missions in the mountains of Afghanistan with the U.S. Special Forces hunting the Taliban. We will discuss what is happening on the ground as Karzai asks for more American money for his family and cronies. Then finally, with yesterday the third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, which took 300,000 lives and left over a million others homeless, we'll be joined in studio by Amy Wilentz, the author of a new book, Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She has an article in, also has an article in today's Los Angeles Times. For journalists today, the whole world is watching. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow at the Director of the Global Finance Project at the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanships of Joseph Stiglitz. And previously, Robert Johnson was a Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And do you accept the premise in my introduction, Rob, that the question is, does Jack Lew, since he's a budget expert, does he understand finance, does he understand Wall Street, and does he understand the systemic risk posed by the banks that are now even too big to fail? And if there is a another meltdown, and apparently there's no early warning system in place, the Treasury next time simply won't have the funds to bail out Wall Street.
Well, I would say the criticisms that Jack Lew is not an expert in, which you might call the architecture of the financial system, are quite valid. On the same time, someone who's worked in that realm, but very intensely over time, someone like Tim Geithner, who is part of the Robert Rubin sensibility, may have a great deal of expertise, but he essentially governed of, by, and for the banks, not for the people, not for a system that, in the medium term has the stability and avoids the too-big-to-fail problems and the systemic propagation that we all fear right now. So I don't know if Jake Lew should be criticized in the sense that he could get a constellation of undersecretaries and deputies, but the real question is he, as another member of the Rubin fold, is likely to adopt the same perspective. And as Bob Kuttner once said, we do not have a team of rivals, we have a team of Rubins across the spectrum in Obama's economic policy. And this man who talked about vote for hope and change is really just doing reruns on the Clinton administration.
So how can you explain that, though, Rob Johnson, given that Wall Street gave most of their money to Romney and Obama got money from Main Street, from average Americans, and, of course, in 2008, he got the lion's share of Wall Street's money, no doubt about it. What does he owe Wall Street? Why isn't he pivoting back to Main Street, where he really owes a debt to, and why is he indulging Wall Street, who did everything they could to prevent his re-election?
Well, my sense is that Obama, first of all, is not a particularly sophisticated financial and economic thinker. He's much better on issues like constitutional law and what have you. So, being a little bit fish out of water, he's afraid, in my sense, of what you might call aggravating the confidence of Wall Street. It's almost as if the entire society and system now is hostage to these large, concentrated financial institutions who can do so much harm. And Obama may be very well-meaning in his desire to, what you might call, facilitate the recovery and create confidence and fortify the well-being of America. But you can't do that without the financial sector in the current structure. So I think he's between a rock and a hard place, because a proper financial system, properly structured, properly regulated, properly supervised, would take an awful lot of power out of the hands of the sector that has been absolutely the most powerful sector in America for the last 20 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. So, what then, in terms of forming a countervailing alliance against the power of Wall Street? Surely there are economic interests in the United States that recognize the continuing financialization of our economy means that it's unsustainable over the long term, because Wall Street's only mostly about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And the traditional American industries, and I suppose an example out here in California are the Silicon Valley people. They're about innovation and creating products, not making paper profits. Can you organize a countervailing economic force to curtail the domination of our economy by Wall Street?
Well, I think, as you say, it's imperative that we do create an economic and political structure which is oriented towards a broader sharing of the proceeds. When you bring up Silicon Valley, the only thing I take issue with is an awful lot of their technological innovation has been associated with displacement of labor and increasingly skilled labor. And a lot of the Silicon Valley firms have been very, very aggressive in this last year or two, doing stock buybacks and other things, not investing in R&D, and shedding pensions and shedding high-level wage employees in favor of younger people who are overseas who work for less than half the price.
So they've got the disease as well. it's systemic and endemic, right, in American capitalism.
And the other factor is top managements are paying themselves with stock options and fantastic creations of financial engineering. So even a non-financial corporation that may be what you might call the base of a broad prosperity and sharing works in partnership with investment bankers and with Wall Street and engineers the compensation structures of that company to benefit investors in the stock market and benefit top management, often to the detriment of the rest of the company.
So, Rob Johnson, an example of that, of course, is in Sunday's New York Times, an article called Our Economic Pickle by Stephen Greenhouse that points out that Caterpillar, long a symbol of American industry, while it reported record profits last year, it insisted on a 6-year wage freeze for many of its blue-collar workers, and wages have fallen to a record low as a share of America's gross domestic product. Last year's wages fell to a record low of 43.5%, and since 2001, when the wage share was 49%. So there's pretty stark evidence that capital has been the beneficiary of increased productivity, but American capitalists are not sharing the bounty with their workers.
That's right, and I think the presence of increased global competition from very, very intense, particularly Asian, Indian, and Chinese workforce, is driving down the returns to wages and driving up the returns to capital, just as someone like Paul Samuelson predicted would happen in the early 1970s. At the time he received the Nobel Prize, he wrote an article for the Swedish Chamber of Commerce called International Trade for a Rich Country, which was all about how, with the dynamism of technical change and large pools of unskilled labor in developing countries, we were going to have some tough sledding for 30 or 40 years in the United States. And if anything, he underestimated the depth and duration of this challenge.
Well, is that to say then, Rob Johnson, that globalism has become an excuse for American capitalists to be greedy?
What's clear, when you look at comparative statistics, Germany, the Scandinavians, some Latin American countries, that none of this is inevitable. These are policy choices. In Germany, the distribution of wealth and income has not been widening particularly. Lots of people in the blue-collar and lower-level world. I'm sitting in Detroit, Michigan today, and the devastation of the auto industry in Detroit is not matched by a similar devastation of the auto industry in Germany, and both countries faced the same global economy. So some of this is technology. Some of this has to do with globalization, but a lot of it has to do with the policy choices and the definition and the vision of what constitutes a society. Regulation, role of labor unions, the tax code are all parts of this architecture. And in the United States, what you call the capitalist class have gotten away with their designs, much to the detriment of a very large proportion of the population.
So my understanding, though, in Germany, and it's kind of an irony that the Marshall Plan that we rescued the German and European economies and Japan's economy and gave them these economic structures, including full health care and all of the things that we don't have over here. But one of the things that they have in Germany, my understanding, is that the companies that you just mentioned, the German auto industry, on the boards of directors of BMW and Mercedes and other German car companies, 50% of the seats on the boards of directors are given over to union representation.
I think they do a much better job of representing all the stakeholders and the creation of value added in the German auto industry than they do really in any sector in the United States. Probably the only sector in the United States, and this is a laughable irony, that is thoroughly represented as a workforce is the Wall Street workforce and the amount of bonus pool that they take out of those publicly listed companies. The stocks of places like Morgan Stanley, Citibank, and others tolerate a huge compensation pool for their workforce, something that would not be tolerated in any other sector.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and he was formerly Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist for the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. So what is the problem here then in terms of the public's understanding of the economy? Because you have these well-funded deficit hawks like the Wall Street billionaire Pete Peterson has been out spending a lot of his money to tell us the sky is falling and that the deficits are ruining us and that should be our priority, that all Americans, working Americans and middle-class Americans should tighten their belts, while people on Wall Street should be we should take the handcuffs off and unrestrain them and their wealth will trickle down. Now, contrast that with Jack Kennedy's famous line, a rising tide raises all boats. Why not at this moment where we're going to have another economic hostage crisis over the debt ceiling and the deficit hawks are going to go to the mat for the billionaires, even though that drives up the cost of debt as it did last time when we get downgraded because of their insane antics? Why not have a countervailing debate? Why doesn't the White House step up here and say, wait a minute, these people are insane, but this is what we really need to bring our economy back?
I believe, going back to the start of your question, what the public is not acknowledging, at one level they understand this, but they are not acknowledging the powerful feedback loops that exist between wealth and the manipulation of the rules of the game. A capitalist democracy receives its legitimacy from being democratically governed. But when you can buy and sell the rules of the game, the powerful can reset the rules over and over again to their benefit and the public's detriment. Pete Peterson may be correct in a sensible sense that there is a budget crisis, but the budget crisis does not come from all the little people of America over-consuming. It comes from concentrated interests who who are holding fundraisers for those same self-righteous congressmen and senators talking about a budget crisis, so that we have health care costs that are more than double what any other country has, while being only rated 37th in the world in the quality of the care that we provide. And you have concentrated interests, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. And then you have all these kind of ridiculous compensating things where doctors are forced to go through all kinds of hoops when they're not making extraordinary incomes in comparison with the biotechnology of pharmaceuticals and insurance companies. So I believe we actually have to return medicine to the care of doctors and take it out of the hands of businessmen. The businessmen are backing people up like they're pushing you against the wall because of the vulnerabilities of your health. Biggest cause of bankruptcy in America and the biggest cause of deficit concerns in America are our dysfunctional health system. But the broader point that applies to finance, military-industrial complex, and everything else is that we will not fix our budget problems until we fix our governance problems and get money out of politics.
Well, you would think that a political argument could be offered that, for example, it's the Republicans who are essentially the welfare queens. Look at what happened under the Republican Congress when they forbid the U.S. government in Medicare from collective bargaining and bulk buying of pharmaceuticals to drive down the cost. And one of the reasons why we have out of control medical costs is that the drug pharmaceutical monopolies basically can write their own ticket because the government is prevented by the Republican Congress from from competitive bidding. And
the only place, Ian, where I would differ with your comment is this is not a Republican problem or a Democrat problem. This is a bipartisan problem that is a structural problem in the competition for campaign contributions and the competition for contributions, because we no longer have a system in the House or the Senate where leadership positions are the basis of seniority and longevity in office. They're the basis of who raises the most money, who puts the most on the table. The people who are the most corrupt in selling policy, and I use the term corrupt because it's legal, but it is legal corruption, those are the people who assume power, and the system is designed to generate corporate welfare, what economists call rent-seeking, and it is not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem, though you may be perhaps right that the Republicans' anti-government diatribes are the most disingenuous because they are also at the center of this fundraising competition.
Well, Rob, I don't want to leave in despair. What's your final prescription here?
I'm reading a book right now by James Cone, theologian at Union Theological Seminary. It's called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And the parable of our current, or the analogy or the metaphor of our current time, is that when things get bad, such as the lynching and the racism, it sets in motion a redemptive energy, a coiling spring, and a power. And the population, if they care for the values of this 200-and-some-year experiment called the United States of America, the population has to now start engaging, become active, not only in scrutinizing and studying, but they have to start voting people out of office and demanding changes in the rules and even constitutional amendments. We need broad-based, active, collective action. Despondency will not do. And as Dr. Cone talks about in The Cross and the Lynching Tree, after a certain point, you know that your only path is to take action and to resist these evils. And I think we're getting closer to that time right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Johnson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and of the United States Senate Budget Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to Robert Young Pelton, who just spent the last 5 weeks in the mountains of Afghanistan with the U.S. Special Forces hunting down the Taliban. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, and he's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has just spent 5 weeks on missions in the mountains of Afghanistan with U.S. Special Forces hunting the Taliban. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
How are you? How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Now, you have... you went into Afghanistan with the U.S. invasion back in after 9/11, and you were there actually when the CIA officer was killed in the prison revolt, and then that's when the American Taliban was captured. I believe he spent the night in your digs with you until he was handed over. And so you were with the Special Forces then, and you've just gotten back from having spent 5 weeks with them now, 11 years later. So just start with that. 11 years later, what are the guys at the tip of the spear feel about what's happening there?
Well, it's the exact same unit, actually. The new unit was called ODA 5335, but they were the same unit that fought on horseback with General Dostum in 2001. So I wanted to use that historical window to compare the mission. And the first thing I noticed is that we're running a very risk-adverse war there. It takes about 40 pages of PowerPoint presentations for a special operations unit to get out the door, out the gate. They're not allowed to walk around or mingle unless they've got a certain level of protection. And any missions we do have extraordinary amounts of protection, air platforms, weapon platforms, things like that.
But in terms of the impression was that the Taliban were fairly soundly and quickly defeated back in 2001, 2002, and now 11 years later, they're coming back, aren't they? Wherever there's there aren't Americans or aren't Afghan forces, the Taliban seem to be infiltrating back into all parts of Afghanistan.
Correct. And then what you're saying is an ugly divorce. You know, we are not supporting Afghanistan or doing the same thing. What the U.S. is doing now is trying to keep the ring roads open so we can get our junk out of Afghanistan. And what Karzai is doing, because he lost the support of the North, he's bringing back the Taliban so that whichever crony or group he supports to protect his legacy will be deeply intertwined with the Taliban, which, of course, the North is very upset about. So you have two completely different activities going on. You have the American activity, which is getting out of there, and you have the Afghan activity, or Karzai's activity, which is to bring back the Taliban, and almost ignoring the North.
So the kleptocrat in chief, as I called him in the opening, Karzai, is there. He is in the White House, in the Oval Office, with President Obama. And does President Obama know that the Karzai family only care about themselves, and that they're working behind America's back, cultivating deals with the Taliban in Kandahar and in the south and in the east, so that that will be that will be their ticket to stay on the gravy train after we leave.
Right. Well, ever since 2007, 2008, the State Department briefs have been highly critical of Karzai because he was wooing China, Pakistan, Iran, basically the people we were trying to edge out. But these are the countries coming in to scoop up the financial benefit of what we've achieved. And he used to speak with two voices. You know, he used to be very anti-American in his native Dari. And then, of course, when he spoke in English, he'd be somewhat stern, but always sort of supportive. Right now, we know that under a Karzai administration, the U.S. will not have much breathing room. So the only thing that President Obama wanted was to guarantee that U.S. forces that do remain behind are not subject to Afghan laws, which is a similar deal to what we tried to do in Iraq and didn't get.
But still, the idea that you're with the special forces and they go out every night to try and kill the Taliban, and meanwhile, Karzai, our so-called leader, is meeting with the president in the Oval Office, he's inviting them in the back door.
Right. If you go to President Karzai's official page, you'll scroll down, you'll see that he's looking forward to the day that he can release all 3,000 prisoners from Bagram. And I think about a week ago, he released about 80, and a few days before that, he released 150. He wants to trade these chips. You know, he wants to show the Taliban in Pakistan that he's their friend. I read the draft deal memo between Pakistan and Afghanistan to reconciliate the Taliban. And they're also going to work with Haqqani and also Hekmatyar, the exact same people that, like you said, our troops are out killing every night or capturing.
So this is, not a grand bargain. It's a grand betrayal. I mean, it's been this way for some time, though. It's been pretty obvious that the Pakistanis have been stabbing the U.S. in the back. But it has been less obvious that that Karzai is stabbing them in the back. It's been pretty clear that he is a kind of narco-kleptocrat, and his family are stashing, and his cronies are stashing as much money as they can steal in the Gulf.
This is going to be somewhat Shakespearean. There's no guarantee that Karzai is going to survive. I spent some time with General Dostum and members of the new political party in the North, and they want substantial changes to the Constitution to allow regional, you know, voting to actually put in power people who represent the North. And they also want Karzai and his cronies out, and if possible, probably in jail. Because if Karzai does not elect a sympathetic person or a relative, they will investigate him and probably charge him and his family with a lot of misappropriation of funds. So it's a very serious battle that's going to occur over the next 4 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, and he's had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. And he's just spent 5 weeks on missions in the mountains of Afghanistan with U.S. Special Forces hunting the Taliban. Now, my understanding is, apart from the fact that the Taliban are pushing cells into areas abandoned by the U.S., I understand that Afghan police units have been engaged in fighting against, which of course, are trained by the U.S., fighting against the other group trained by the U.S., the Afghan military.
Right. I mean, what we've done is we've created about 300,000 badly trained but armed soldiers who are supposed to provide security in these regions, but they're actually being used as sort of private armies or chips to gain control over areas before the Americans leave. So when I was over there, we had an incident in which the head of the police
had shot to death, I think, two Afghan Special Forces members and had to be arrested by the army, and they engaged themselves in a pitched battle. And unfortunately, the Americans were sitting there going, well, you know, we train and support both these groups, so they had to just sit there and watch it take place. Now, this is what you're going to see happening all over the country, because these security forces, and I put sort of quotation marks around them, the police and the army, don't have any vested interest in defending some place that's hundreds of miles from their village or home. So when the pay stops and when the discipline stops, and the U.S. does provide an extraordinary amount of discipline with these troops, they will just go back to their homes, set up their own militias, and start fighting over turf.
Well, but that leads to the real question about Afghanistan's future. I mean, we, of course, you know, the White House, I think, suggested that they'd be willing to pull everybody out as a bargaining lever against Karzai, you know, wanting to grab as much as he could. They're talking about maybe leaving 10,000 behind. But surely the issue is not one of how many boots on the ground, it's how much money. I mean, we spent $120 billion last year. We spent close to $600 billion, that's the official figure, it's probably higher than that, in Afghanistan so far. And this is a country that simply cannot pay its way. It's not a country that generates enough income by any measure, and it's a ward of the world, a basket case. So, who's going to step in when the American gravy train goes away?
Well, let's just recap. First of all, Afghanistan was, if not the poorest, one of the poorest countries on earth when the U.S. arrived in 2001. It is now a very active, sprawling country with a huge sort of middle class of people who have benefited from this avalanche of cash. So the cities are full of educated, smart, hardworking Afghans. Those Afghans are all trying to get visas to get out of there. Secondly, the U.S. position was that they would leave behind special operations troops and basically attrit any Talib or Al-Qaeda units that pop up. But to do that requires a massive infrastructure of aviation, logistics, intelligence, things like that. I personally support the idea that we should go back to a zero-based concept, take everybody out of there, and if we choose to go back in lightly and quickly without this massive, expensive infrastructure. You know, I sent you some numbers on what it actually takes to keep just one soldier. It's about $1 million a year. How much fuel costs to fly in, et cetera, et cetera. We've always been slightly tweaking the war in Afghanistan over 10 years, and it's turned into the exact, you know, monster that will never win a war. So I think we should reboot and start from scratch.
Well, when it costs up for between $100 and $600 a gallon gasoline, and of course a lot of it's used for air conditioning and other sort of luxuries, if you will, or necessities that may to the soldiers. You were mentioning earlier that the main mission now for the U.S. is to secure the roads so that they can get the hell out of there with all this equipment. We know several times the Pakistanis have extorted, they've shut off the supply routes through Pakistan, and they try to extort more money per tonnage that comes through. Apparently, some arrangements have been made to extract some of this material via the stands, the former Russian colonies. But the long and the short of it are the bad guys, meaning the ISI, the Pakistanis, and the Taliban, who apparently are all in cahoots, are they going to create problems so that somebody ends up with all that American equipment?
Yeah, I mean, we have, if you fly over, if you look on satellite photos, we are building massively huge facilities to house the police and the military, and we're hoping to keep a permanent presence in Bagram and some other major places, but we do have to get out tens of thousands of troops and hundreds of thousands of containers. All those countries know that there's a cost to pay, and that's originally how they used to make money in Afghanistan, is charging you to move down the road from city to city, so it's a well-known way to make money. The the fact that we would leave tiny bits of troops in there always makes us vulnerable to the predatory politics of either the stands or Pakistan. So we're not in a good place if we stay, and we're not in a good place if we leave, but we're probably in a better place if we leave, because you remember the first troops, the first special forces team, moved around on horseback. They didn't need fuel, and they had air support, which was run out of foreign air force bases, and we weren't tied to the ground, and we supported the Northern Alliance, who was a, sort of the antidote to the Taliban. We then dumped on them and went with Karzai. So there still is a way to keep Afghanistan stable, but it's going to go through a period of extreme violence and political turmoil.
And division, surely. It sounds like we'll be back to the Taliban versus the Northern Alliance.
Yeah, the Hindu Kush is the barrier between what would be a Taliban-run Pashtunistan and the North, which is a very vibrant, sort of secular, successful region.
So tell me, in the last few minutes then, Robert Young-Pelton, given that you went in there with the initial U.S. invasion after 9/11 and went in with the special forces and were there, as I mentioned, at Mazar-e Sharif when the CIA office was killed in the prison outbreak, and you ended up having to host the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, for the night until he was handed over to the, I guess, the U.S. Marines, the Special Forces.
No, he was handed over to the agency. And then
the agency. Okay. And then you've just come back from after 5 weeks on missions with the Special Forces, the same unit that you went in with in the first place. I was Stanley McChrystal's out selling a book at the moment, and he was talking about how, because he was a head of Special Forces, how when they went in, a lot of the guys were, you know, in their 30s and 40s. So that was the original Special Forces, and they were cautious and apparently weren't so gung-ho. Tell us about the Special Forces of today. What are they like?
The Green Berets today are working in an extraordinarily rich environment of intelligence, weapons, choices. So on some of our missions into small towns in the mountains, we had 6 levels of aerial platforms with weapons and observation. They have 10 years of data to mine to figure out who's who and what's what. They have extraordinary intelligence gathering in both electronics, human resources, and just generally people in Afghanistan that don't want the Taliban to come back. And so they are very, I would have to say, focused and also very efficient in bringing down any cells of Taliban that are shipped in from Pakistan. But the problem is that there are large areas of Afghanistan that are simply abandoned by the U.S., and they fully know that the Taliban are setting up political and military units there. So it's a hard task to keep back the constant flow of resources and people from Pakistan.
Well, just in closing, Robert Young-Pelton, how do the Special Forces feel about their long involvement? They were the first in, and they'll be the last out, and some will stay behind. 11 years later, billions of dollars later, thousands of lives later. How do they feel about Afghanistan and the U.S. Involvement there?
Well, they're trained to do this, but some of these guys have been rotated 10 times, if not more, in both Iraq and Afghanistan. They're burdened by an extraordinary amount of bureaucracy, or I guess you'd call it BS, for lack of a better word. They want to do their job, which is unconventional warfare. They're doing very conventional warfare, almost like police work. And I think a lot of them just want to go back and have kids and enjoy their lives and not do something that'll get them killed and then sort of forgotten about. So it was a little depressing, to tell you the truth, but the men themselves are extraordinary.
But no discussions of whether it was worth it in any sense, or what did we achieve, or what's it all been about?
They're soldiers. They're soldiers. They do what they're told. They don't dabble in politics. And if they're told to go do something, they do it. And, you know, when you sit back and talk about the bigger picture, obviously they have the same opinions that you and I do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Robert Young-Pelton.
My pleasure, as always, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, and he's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He's just spent 5 weeks on missions in the mountains of Afghanistan with U.S. Special Forces hunting the Taliban. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined in studio by Amy Wilentz, the author of the new book, Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is award-winning writer Amy Wilentz, who's the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California in Irvine. Her latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She has and also has an article in the Los Angeles Times. For journalists today, the whole world is watching. And Amy Wilentz will be speaking at the Downtown Public Library this coming Tuesday, January the 15th at 7:15, in conversation with KPFK's John Wiener. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Wilentz.
Thank you, Ian.
And let's begin with your opinion piece in Sunday's LA Times about you being the skunk at the picnic, right?
Yeah. Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it used to be said that the role of journalism was to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. And
right.
I think,
speak truth to power.
I think to some extent we've maybe lost our way. So what is it when, you know, describe the scene at the garment factory in Haiti and how you were the skunk at the picnic by being a journalist.
Well, first of all, I had written a blog that attacked this garment factory. And what bloggers can do now is, you know, figure out what's going on, use their contacts to learn what's going on, and then write about it without ever going there. So I had written about this garment factory without ever going there, but I had my very strongly held opinions about the garment industry in the Third World, as it used to be known, and especially in my little corner of the Third World, Haiti. So I wrote a rather intemperate piece calling it the new plantation or something like that. And all the people involved in getting this garment factory into Haiti finally read my blog and had a breakdown and started yelling at me. And one email from one of the people who had been there started, "I am so disappointed." But what happened was then I got an invitation to go see the factory. And I still have the same opinion of it, but it's a very nice sweatshop. There's no sweat involved.
I see.
There's a cooling system, for example.
Right.
It's like a model garment factory.
But the people who are mad at you are not just regular folks.
No.
Bill and Hillary Clinton, Sean Penn, Ben Stiller, and the president of Haiti, Michel Martelly.
Michel Martelly, yes, true. They're all mad at me, but the person who was maddest at me was the person in the State Department who helped get this factory into Haiti. So, and he's the one who actually then invited me to go to the factory, which is good. Like in Haiti in the old days, if you wrote something mean and anyone ever found out about it, which was rare that anyone noticed what you'd written about Haiti in the old days, you didn't get an invitation then to see what you had maligned. You got threats and death threats. So I guess it's a little better in this world.
So you mentioned in your new book, Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti, Amy Wilentz, that you're in love with this maddening place. And I've often wondered what it is that attracts people like yourself, like Bill Clinton, right. Like Sean Penn, people who really know the country but feel some special need to do what they can at the same time sort of recognizing a certain futility. So I'm trying to figure that out. Well,
it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, for me, and I look at this very issue in the book. The book is largely about what outsiders do in Haiti, why they come to Haiti, what they feel about Haiti, why there are recidivists like me or Sean Penn or Bill Clinton is probably the grandest of the recidivists in Haiti, the outsiders who keep coming down. And I think, of course, part of it, not I won't speak for myself on this because I was simply seduced by the country, but for a lot of people, they want to do good. And where better to do good than in a place that is so obviously desperate for something good to happen? So that's the initial impulse for Sean Penn, certainly, probably for Bill Clinton. But then when you're there, one, the country is so seductive, so that led me to stay. And also, for people like Clinton or Penn, it's very welcoming. I mean, and you can have a fantastic time, and not in a bad way. It's not bad to say this, but you know, you become a very important person in this world very quickly. For me, it took me 15 years to have anyone ever recognize me, even though I was like for a long time one of the few white people there. But for Sean Penn and Bill Clinton, you know, it's mass adulation as well as the feeling that you're doing good.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by award-winning writer Amy Wilanski, author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California in Irvine, and her latest book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She also has an article at the Los Angeles Times for Journalists Today, The Whole World is Watching. And of course, we're speaking on the third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti that took 300,000 lives and left over 1 million homeless. You mentioned there's something seductive about the place. Let's start with that, but then also trying to address, you know, what has or hasn't happened since this tragedy 3 years ago.
Well, what's seductive about the place is the culture. So culture is created by people, so the people also. But the culture in Haiti is very vivid. Because it's so poor, the culture is outwardly visible. And then the artworks by Haitians, even the worst of the tourist art that you can see sitting waiting in a dusty condition by the roadside, real paintings, even the worst of them is kind of sweet and darling, but the great ones, these are real master painters, and so there's that. There's the traditional religion, Vodou, which I write about in the book and which my main character is based on. Even though this is a work of nonfiction, there is this character, Fred Voodoo, who haunts the book. And that's an incredible belief system, a fabulous, rich tradition, which you can see both in its fancy tourist forms and in its lesser forms. But let's talk about the earthquake a little bit, because the earthquake, in a way, is the greatest tourist event that ever happened in Haiti. So Haiti has a lot of beautiful historical things to see. There's the citadel built by former slaves in the early 1800s. It's a giant fortress on a mountaintop in the north of Haiti. And there are other things like that to be seen, historic things that were not touched by the earthquake. But people have come to see that from the outside, but the numbers, the droves of people who came down after the earthquake to help, it was a gigantic influx. All those dusty paintings that used to sit there got bought up right away by all the aid workers in the initial relief surge, and then continuing the reconstruction surge. But what happened in Haiti, and I think it happens in the rest of the world, is that when countries from the outside give a huge amount of money to countries that who are suffering from a disaster, it's very hard to get that money to the hands of the people who are suffering. What often happens is it goes to contractors from the outside. It goes to half of the initial relief money the United States gave went to the Defense Department of the United States to keep the peace in Haiti, which was, to my mind, largely unnecessary, not entirely unnecessary. So a lot of money gets lost going back into the very institutions that have fundraised it. A lot of money goes to vehicles, to staff, to housing for the relief people. And it's hard to get the money into the hands of Haitians, say, in this case. And very much of the money that was earmarked for Haiti is still sitting in bank accounts. It gets shifted between bank accounts as projects fail. A lot of it has just simply not been dispersed. Some millions, like 400 million, I can't remember the exact figure, is still sitting with the International Red Cross. It was so easy to raise money in the wake of the earthquake initially, but so hard to get the money out there. I don't entirely blame the aid organizations, but really, I think they could have done a better job.
So how many people are homeless then today? Do
you today, know? It is 358,000 plus. Still living in camps.
So two-thirds have found homes.
Two-thirds have gotten out, have found homes, have been relocated with the help of international organizations. There was something called 616. They wanted to get a 16th of the population out into six neighborhoods or something, or a sixth, I can't remember. But they did give $500 per family to a bunch of people in camps to get those people out of those particular camps, the most visible and the largest camps. But what that meant is the people in the smaller camps, there are about 490 little camps housing those 358,000 people. Those people are now waiting for their $500, wouldn't you? That's a lot of money in Haiti, where the average family lives on $350 a year.
So is there there's been a lot of talk about some of the sort of deeper systemic problems. Let's start with the fact that everybody cooks with charcoal, which means that the deforestation happens and continues to happen, and there's very little left in terms of the native forests. And of course, when it rains, which it does often, and there are hurricanes, the topsoil is washed away. People are flooded, etc. So you would think that at some point or other there'd be some discussion about maybe there's got to be another way to cook food.
Well, Haitians aren't backward because they're insistently, stubbornly backward. A lot of the problem with charcoal and deforestation has been caused by the fact that the rice industry, rice cultivation was so undermined by the dumping of U.S. Taxpayer-subsidized surplus rice into the Haitian market by U.S. policy in the 1980s and 1990s. What happened was this rice came to market in Haiti and undersold Haitian cultivated rice. Therefore, rice farmers had to turn into the cash economy. And one way to get quickly into the cash economy is to cut down all the trees around your house and turn them into charcoal. So you don't have that big an investment in making that charcoal, and you can get some money for your family fairly rapidly. So that fed into the charcoal. Once there's charcoal available for you to buy at market, and it's pretty cheap, then you're going to cook with charcoal. So the destruction of Haitian agriculture led to a lot more deforestation happening. And people will cook with charcoal if there's not a cheaper alternative. It's efficient, it works, and it gets their food cooked. There are a lot of projects in Haiti to use solar cookers and natural gas cookers. But as far as I've seen, and this is all anecdotal, not scientific evidence, those aren't really working. There must be some problem, some flaw in the design of the programs. Haitians aren't seeing the benefit of using a solar energy source. One problem in Haiti today, or one paradigm that I'm really interested in is, and this happens in the U.S. too, in different communities. Most people I know, if they're going to use solar power, they buy their solar panels, they put them in, and then their solar energy is free. Indeed, sometimes they have so much of it, they sell it back to the power company. In Haiti, the opposite is going to happen. There are many plans to install solar energy among the lower middle classes, people who can probably pay something per month. So a company will come in and install the solar power, and then that company will charge you to use the sun as your power source per month. It just, it totally confounds my understanding of solar power.
Well, didn't you come up with the phrase, the morally repugnant elite?
I wish I had come up with the phrase. I think it's a phrase that was invented by outsiders in Africa or something. Morally repugnant elite, which happens to be the same initials, MRE, as meals ready to eat that are distributed in relief situations. So,
they're still there, right?
Yeah, oh, they're still there. Very much still there. In fact, a member of the morally repugnant elite was recently, in an incredible turnabout, arrested in Haiti for kidnapping other members of the morally repugnant elite. A fabulous story. Go online and find it.
Mm-hmm. So given that you have all of these powerful and prominent Americans like former President Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter was down there hammering away, building houses, right?
Yeah.
So, excuse me, I'm still getting over a cold here.
So is everyone.
I know. Well, this is 2 4-year-old twin boys visiting over the holidays. No, it was a lot of fun, but I'm still have the legacy. So tell me though, with all of that compassion, with people like Bill Clinton and Sean Penn, who I understand are doing, you know, it really is
he's an amazing phenomenon.
Yeah. You know, with all this Yankee know-how, how come is it going to make a difference, systemically, or is it just continually? I mean, I hate to sound like this, but that's the question, and we've only got a couple of minutes left here. So
sometimes I think that all the earthquake reconstruction that hasn't worked is kind of a Haitian resistance, that they're resisting being occupied again by the United States. They were occupied from 1915 to 1934, and a lot got done by the United States, but it was done with like virtual slave Haitian labor, et cetera. So sometimes I think that it's actually an active resistance. But, you know, so much of it is misguided and so much of it is underfunded, even though there's so much money waiting to be used. So we have to wait and see. Also, it's only 3 years after a massive disaster.
Well, Amy Willens, I'm sorry we ran out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio. Again, I've been speaking with Amy Willens, who's the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California in Irvine. Her latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She has an article in Los Angeles Times for Journalists Today, The Whole World is Watching. And Amy Willens will be speaking at the Downtown Public Library this coming Tuesday, January the 15th at 7:15 p.m. in conversation with KPFK's John Wiener. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.